This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James, joined today by Tanner Beamer. Tanner's with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Tanner, hey, great to see you.
Good to see you as always, Tony.
All right, I would like to think that things have slowed down for you because we're looking at pretty good markets right now for cattle. Does that mean there's no concerns within the market right now or marketing?
You know, everything's just hunky-dory. Congress has decided they don't need to interject themselves into the marketing process, and cattle producers are happy, so I've just been sipping Mai Tais for the last several weeks. I kid, of course. Certainly the markets have recovered in really strong form from the COVID-19 pandemic. That's kind of bittersweet in a lot of ways. A lot of that has been drought-fueled liquidation that has resulted in some of the scarcity that you're seeing in the cattle supplies, which has helped inflate some of the prices for fat cattle, calves, feeder cattle, and the like. Certainly a welcome development for producers who have been struggling to maintain profitability for a number of years, but we're still facing really high interest rates, really high input costs. Basis is kind of out of whack in some parts of the country. So there's certainly challenges remaining for cattle producers, but all in all, a much more favorable marketing environment than we've seen in the past couple years. Our goal now at this point is to make sure that Congress or the agencies don't do anything that could upend that significant progress that we've seen and allow the market to reach prices that we haven't seen in some cases ever, and in other cases, certainly for several decades.
So let's rewind the clock, and for someone who might not remember or might not know really the background, the story here, we started seeing this happen around when COVID hit, the pandemic, where things really got out of whack, and one segment of that industry wasn't getting much pie at all. Another one was getting a good chunk of pie. Kind of set the stage for us where we were and how we ended where we are today, or not ended, but where we are today.
Sure. So I like to always go back to the Holcomb fire in 2019, because I think that kind of sets where the fundamentals were at that particular moment in time, right? The COVID-19 pandemic was certainly orders of magnitude worse, but we were already in a pretty dangerous position just by nature of the cattle cycle when that Holcomb fire hit in August of 2019, right? You saw very, very high supplies of market-ready cattle and not a whole lot of hooks available to process them. And then the Holcomb fire hits and you see this microcosm of what we didn't know at the time but was going to be the COVID-19 pandemic, right? At the time, we were processing at capacity, somewhere between 650 and 660,000 head of cattle per week. And so when you took 6% of that shackle space offline in the Holcomb fire, or 40% of that shackle space offline during the COVID-19 pandemic, that took an already unfavorable part of the cattle cycle for cattle producers and magnified it tenfold and made that situation untenable to the point where you did see meteoric box beef prices at a time when cattle producers were losing money left and right. Thankfully, we've recovered from that somewhat in the last several months. There's still definitely some progress that can be made, but by and large, you know, that supply-demand imbalance has rectified itself. Again, just sort of by nature of the cattle markets figuring itself out and bringing itself back into equilibrium. We don't have the same high supplies of cattle that we did 2 years ago. As a matter of fact, we're looking at a position where we are seeing cattle as more of a scarce resource. We're processing today between 600 and 610,000 head of cattle as opposed to 660,000 a couple years ago. So we're not processing at full capacity right now. And so when you see some of these minor plant disruptions come up, they don't have the same ripple effect throughout the entire industry as once they did. And as a result, you're seeing fat cattle prices climb to places that we've never seen them before. We just set a spot live cattle futures contract price record a couple weeks ago, and that I think was somewhere in the ballpark of $172 a hundredweight. And the cash market is even incredibly strong for fats as well. So we're in a fundamentally a different place than we were a couple years ago. And ultimately, that cycle is going to come back. We're going to hit another tipping point where You might see some of that processing capacity fall offline again, just as a result of fewer cattle moving through the system. And then the pendulum will start to swing back the other way again, as is the nature of the long-term cattle cycle. But for right now, producers are experiencing some pretty good prices that we're hoping can help them weather some of the storms that will lie ahead in 3, 5, 7 years.
Back as this was really coming to a boiling point, if you will, there were calls for adding more processing capacity. There were some concerns at that point that adding that capacity could be dangerous if we ended up in an event where we had fewer cattle to actually market. Is that a concern for some who have stepped out and started building those plants?
I think it depends on the business model of each of those types of plants. And we've been pretty vocal from the very beginning, right? I think it was about a year and a half ago that USDA first announced that they were using some of this COVID relief money to invest in small and regional packer processing. And some of those facilities, I think, have really good business models where they have really identified a niche that will allow them to compete at a robust level, but without necessarily taking on the same market share, going after the same market share that the big four are currently control. And I think that's really important, right? Because packing is an economies of scale game, and a smaller guy is going to have a much harder time competing with some of those more well-established firms. These new plants that are coming online, though, several of them have, you know, different business models that might, you know, check a different box for a consumer, right? They might put some sort of a value-added claim on there. They might say that they're sourcing their beef from a certain local area around where the plant is. They might be, you know, doing some sort of a different product differentiation in terms of quality or different programs that the cattle can be enrolled in. I think that those niche market business models are actually going to be pretty strong moving forward. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that beef demand is still just rock solid, both domestically and in our major export markets. People just want U.S. beef. And that demand pull is really what has sustained this market for the past several years. We produce the highest quality beef in the world, and consumers across the globe want a piece of it. And so long as those smaller regional packers are taking advantage of that and they're marketing to people in new ways, and we're marketing beef in immensely more complex ways than we ever have in history, and just there's plenty of margin available at the table for those that want to carve out their own little piece of it, and I think that that's where you're going to see those smaller guys succeed.
So we've talked about the cattlemen, cattlewomen. In my mind, I've been thinking cow-calf, maybe stocker through there. And then we're talking packer, which means we've left out an entire segment in there that really has had it tough for a few years, and that's the feeder side of this. When you look at the spectrum right now, are the feeders at a point where they're in the black?
You know, I think it depends on the feedlot, but I would say that overall, generally speaking, the feeders are in a much better leverage position than they were a couple years ago. Obviously, you've got some regional basis concerns, particularly corn basis right now with those inflated prices, and that's really going to be what makes or breaks a lot of those guys. But, you know, like I said, Americans and our major export markets, they want U.S. beef, and cattle feeders have the raw materials that make that beef. And so they're going to be in a pretty good leverage position in negotiating for additional margin from those packers. And that actually benefits both the stocker and the cow-calf producer as well, because there's more margin to flow back for higher quality cattle. And so that really is a better position for the entire cattle supply chain, not just the cattle feeders.
Well, can't let you go without asking about appropriations as well. Talking about squeezed, if you will, we're really at a point where the national debt is approaching just a level we're going to have a hard time keeping up with. As some members of Congress start really trying to batten down the hatches, if you will, how does ag make sure it doesn't lose, if you will, some of the most important funding that's needed.
Yeah. So every year, you know, we have to pass 12 appropriations bills to fund all of the different agencies of the federal government and the legislative and judicial branches as well. Those bills originate in the House of Representatives per the Constitution. And we've already seen four of those 12 bills get introduced in the subcommittees. The agriculture appropriations bill that you mentioned was actually released a couple weeks ago. It was approved favorably by the agriculture subcommittee and is now awaiting consideration in the full House Appropriations Committee. That subcommittee, Mark, pretty drastically made some cuts across USDA's mission areas. I think somewhere in the ballpark of about 8% cuts. But if you pair that with, according to congressional Republicans, if you pair that with some of the offsetting rescissions of unobligated funds from previous acts of Congress, it really only represents about a 2% cut. Of course, that gets spun different ways depending upon which party you belong to. But regardless of what your number is, those are pretty steep cuts. That being said, you know, I think there are a lot of folks, the political dynamics to pass anything on Capitol Hill right now are so delicate. Republicans currently control the House of Representatives by a 5-vote margin, and they are going to be losing one of those Republican votes with the resignation of Congressman Chris Stewart from Utah here in a couple weeks. The consequences of that were on full display in the election of the Speaker, in the passage of the bipartisan debt ceiling agreement. You know, it's very difficult for Republicans to pass things on their own. And I can guarantee you that the Democrats are not going to make it easy on them when it comes to appropriations. And so from the cattle industry's perspective, we're pretty easy. We don't have a whole lot of funding requests in that appropriations cycle. We've got a couple that are pretty important for our members, like funding animal disease traceability, making sure that USDA covers the vast majority of cost for electronic identification for interstate movement of sexually intact cattle, which is going to be required to comply with new rules that are coming out for animal disease traceability. But by and large, we use the appropriations process to get rid of big government in the agricultural sector. I'm talking about things like continuing a delay on electronic logging devices for livestock haulers, rolling back USDA's harmful packers and stockyards rules, keeping the greater sage-grouse from getting listed as an endangered species. These are the types of things that we engage with congressional appropriators on, and I think that those types of policy riders are going to fare very, very well in this appropriation cycle.
Tanner, it's always great to see you. Enjoy our conversations because you're so well-versed in so many areas, almost as if you grew up around cattle.
You know, it's kind of an interesting perspective to grow up on a small operation in southern Idaho and then come to D.C., where I've now been for 6 years working for NCBA, and see how that public policy translates to impacts on the ranch or on the farm. And so, it's been a ride of a lifetime.
Tanner Beamer is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association in Washington, D.C., and joins us on today's Agribusiness Report.